Noreen O'Sullivan retires? Is the government going to find a new Garda commissioner to accept 180 grand a year? Or will they have to go outside the country to find somebody to reform the police force? And Providence Resources fails to strike oil off the coast of Ireland once again. Are we ever going to strike any sort of black gold? I'm Ian Guider, and you're very welcome to The Post Podcast. And you're very welcome along to the Post Podcast. A lot to get through because Noreen O'Sullivan, the controversial Garda Commissioner, has retired. Yet another senior police officer retires, even though they have been surrounded in controversy. A lot to talk about around this story. And I'm joined by Michael Brennan, our political editor, and Hugh O'Connell, our political correspondent. Gentlemen, you're both very welcome. I don't think it's a surprise that Noreen O'Sullivan has gone. It may be the timing of it might be a little bit, I suppose, for the government. They had been backing her for the last number of weeks. Will they be a little bit miffed that she's just gone on a Sunday?
I think they're absolutely delighted, Ian, really, that finally a thorn has gone out of their side. They couldn't do anything to force her out after the former Taoiseach Enda Kenny sent a civil servant around to Martin Callan's home in the dead of night and effectively persuaded him to step down from the job. They couldn't get away with that one again because they skated on very thin ice there. So they had to hope that Noreen would eventually crumble under the pressure and go herself. That's what happened. The surprise was it was a bit sooner than one expected, but with the number of controversies and the problems she was in, it was always really on the cards at some stage. She just went a bit quicker than people thought.
I think the timing's probably not ideal from an optics perspective from the government. I suppose they're looking to sort of set the agenda this week. We have the Fine Gael think in on Friday, and now the whole week is spent talking about
another
Garda commissioner gone, and where are we going to find the next one? So that's where the debate has kind of shifted now, is going to be, should we go for an outside, someone outside of the country? That seems to be the narrative now, and also the thorny issue of how much we're going to pay them, because it's now seems to be accepted widely that €180,000 is not enough for a Garda commissioner, and that if you look at international comparisons, we have Garda commissioners in other jurisdictions or police chiefs in other jurisdictions who earn a lot more, and that the salary is going to have to be increased significantly.
Is the imperative now to find somebody from outside on Garda Síochána Corner? Because when you look at the issues facing the force, let's start with some of the big ones. Well, obviously you have the Charlton Tribunal ongoing. You then have the various issues around the Brett Test scandal, the Garda College. Is it now time to say, look, there are too many things happening in on Garda Síochána Corner that another insider, regardless of how well they performed their previous duties, it is just time, like when we cleaned up the banking sector, to go for the external candidate?
I think definitely the signal from government is that they're going to look at all candidates, be they Irish or from right outside the country. Maybe a good example would be Hugh Orde, who was the Chief Constable of the Police Service of Northern Ireland. He was brought in from England. He was shook things up in terms of how that force was run. But the general consensus, he did a really good job. He survived what was a very entrenched force, one which had been basically had officers murdered, which had been very unpopular with the Catholic community, seen as almost sectarian at times. And he managed to turn what was the Royal Ulster Constabulary into the PSNI. Now, if Hugh Orde could do that with them, it is not impossible for the Gardaí to be reformed by someone from outside. But you would like to think there are still members of Garda senior management and people there who, despite the cultural problems we have, are still very good policing officers, and that there's still a core there with the right leadership who can produce a better force. So I think the government will look at all candidates, but realistically, they tried the internal option, which was Noreen. It didn't work. So it is set up for an outsider, if they can decide what to do with the intelligence services, are they willing to give them that as well?
Yeah, before we break it up into crime and intelligence, is it fair to blame it all at Noreen's door? I mean, is it all fair to blame on one person within this organisation? And did she have enough time? I mean, she's been, in her statement, she said, look, I've spent most of my time dealing with Oireachtas committees, public accounts committees, various other inquiries, policing authorities. Is it fair to blame the ills of the force on just one person?
It's not, I think. But Noreen O'Sullivan was handicapped from the beginning because she appeared alongside Martin Callanan at the Public Accounts Committee back in January 2013 at that infamous appearance where he described the actions of Garda whistleblowers as quite disgusting. And I think, you know, the fact that O'Sullivan was beside Callanan indicated that she was very much, you know, from a public perception point of view, she was an insider. She's been in the she had been in the force for 36 years. 33 years at that, or yeah, 33 years at that stage, and she was someone who was perceived as a safe pair of hands, by far the best candidate for the job, but purely on the basis that there wasn't a huge amount of robust talent applying for the job back in 2014. But she was dealing with a succession of scandals that had preceded her. But also, I think questions had arisen about her handling of various issues. I mean, particularly around the O'Higgins Commission and the treatment of Maurice McCabe, and the way in which she apparently had instructed her counsel to approach that. And then, you know, when she, the delay or the apparent delay and the discrepancies around her when she had knowledge of this scandal, the controversy in the Garda College in Templemore and the financial irregularities there, and when she chose to inform the government. So she, you know, she was dealing with legacy issues. She had been very close to her predecessor, and she had mishandled a couple of issues that had arisen over the last 3 years. So it's not fair to blame her. This is a force of 13,000, 14,000 people. But, you know, she was at the top of it. And I think, you know, Michael touched on it earlier, there was a sense of relief in government that, you know, such had been the opposition towards her across the board and the political spectrum, besides from the government. You know, there was a sense that she had to go. And I think that pressure valve has been released now.
I think following on from what you were saying, there were two crucial mistakes that were within her own control that could have made a difference. One was, as been referred to there, the fact that her legal team went and accused Maurice McCabe of acting with malice. Then, unfortunately for them and for Garda management, Maurice McCabe happens to have recorded the meeting where he supposedly acts with malice, and it looks like nothing of that was true at all, and all of a sudden the instructions melt away. But the commissioner, when everybody expected, she proclaimed whistleblowers would be welcome in the force, all of a sudden it comes out that during a private commission of inquiry she's acting very different. The second factor then I'd point to is the handling of the case of Superintendent Dave Taylor, who was a former press officer in the head of the Garda press office. He was placed on leave, effectively suspended, put out in the cold, because he seemed to be getting blamed for the Gardaí taking custody of Roma children, believing they'd been abducted, which was wrong. The rap was given to him. He seemed to become very disaffected by what happened and unhappy with how he was treated. All of a sudden he makes a protected disclosure. You have a tribunal set up. Noreen O'Sullivan will have to now answer questions about whether she was involved in a smear campaign against Maurice McCabe. All of those matters were within her own control, and by not handling them well, she then contributed to her downfall.
What was actually very striking, I thought, about her 3 years in office was that she, you know, she spoke a good game. She talked a good game. She talked about dissent is not disloyalty. She talked about the reforms she wanted to implement to take, you know, to make this a modern police force for the 21st century. But there seemed to be a discrepancy between that and what you were hearing from on Garda Síochána, you know, privately from people working in the guards, from Gardaí themselves. That there, you know, there was serious tension in the senior management level. Chris Donoghue reported in our paper at the weekend how I think there was two members of the senior management team who weren't on speaking terms with O'Sullivan for 2 years. So she had a loyal branch of senior management around her, but beyond that, there didn't seem to be much of a way to get through to Noreen O'Sullivan, and that created problems, I think. So there was a huge discrepancy between what she had been saying publicly and what was actually going on within the force. And you talk to rank and file Gardaí and they'll tell you that morale is on the floor. Now, some of that has to do with issues around pay. Of course, they nearly went on strike last year, but I think more it has to do from what's emanating from a senior management level as well.
And she spoke about being the reformer when she was appointed to succeed Martin Callanan. Actually, before we talk about that, let's just hear a little clip of what she said at an Oireachtas committee about being a reformist.
It is the most radical reform programme. Not everybody likes it. You know, we're going to get a lot of pushback from a lot of quarters when we are doing things that try and make things right. And but the one thing that we are sure is we are absolutely committed to making sure that we see that through.
Sorry, but in your position, if the dog has no confidence in you next week, will you remain on as commissioner?
I have a journey of work that I have to do, and I have to make sure that I see out that commitment, and to make sure that the foundations of what is a modern professional police service that delivers the cultural reform, the structural reform, and the organisational reform that's necessary to achieve that is put in place.
Now, everybody says when they come into a job, we're going to tackle everything and the culture is going to change. Is it even possible right now for the Gardaí to change without having not just a new commissioner, but an entire level of senior management change, bringing in outsiders and perhaps stripping away some of the national security issues from an Garda Síochána?
Yeah, it's certainly possible. I think one good example that has been demanded for about a decade is to mix up the Gardaí, to have more civilians working there, a broader culture. Noreen O'Sullivan, you know, had promised to bring in maybe 800 civilians and replace effectively, put Gardaí who were in behind desk in the Phoenix Park and elsewhere out on the beat, which would give us an instant policing boost. The progress has been painfully slow, maybe about 150 so far at best.
And then you saw her clash with those civilians.
Yeah, that Oireachtas committee where they contradicted themselves over the length of time this meeting took place.
I mean, you have senior civilians within an Garda Síochána, good people who come in recent years, and you know there was a huge, again, discrepancy between what they were saying and what Noreen O'Sullivan was saying.
That would point to the reason why the Gardaí have been so resistant over the years to bring in civilians, because there's a greater chance they may actually shock horror, speak out and tell people what's going on. So to reform the Gardaí, you need to bring in more civilians, give them senior posts. And I think they need to look at the training for Gardaí. Templemore College has been there for a long time, but it doesn't seem to be producing the results that's desired. So do we need to reform how Gardaí are trained? Maybe get other third level colleges involved in mixing it up. And as well, give proper training to senior managers. They're promoting crime fighters to be administrators, guys who were involved out in the beat. They go all the way up. Most other, say the army, for example, recruits in people at officer level, trains them to be leaders. The Gardaí have a very old-fashioned idea.
They don't like outsiders.
They don't like outsiders, but also they raise people right up to the ranks. That's okay, but it shouldn't be the standard way.
Do you think there might be an argument for hiring two people, say, so that you would have like a commissioner in charge of operations, and then you would have a kind of a senior civil servant type manager who would be in charge of sort of reform and restructuring in Garda Síochána? I just wonder, I mean, like, a lot of people have spoken about how this is an impossible job, given, you know, it's claimed two people in 3 years. Would there be, I know they've talked about splitting off the security and intelligence element of it, but would there be an argument to say split it into two so you'd have someone on the operational side and then someone on the kind of internal
structural side? Well, you gave the example, Michael, of the RUC being turned into the PSNI. Of course, that wasn't just a turnover of the chief constable. That was an entire level of senior management that went. They retired, they were paid off early, and they recruited cross-community. Are we at the stage where we now need to say, look at assistant commissioner, deputy commissioner? If we bring in an outsider, they need to bring a whole management team, even a communications team with them, to get out the message that there is going to be serious reform that the public want.
Yeah, I think that certainly needs to be done. And one way of doing it is to something the police authorities look for is to draw on officers from other forces who, there's often, you've seen this series on TVs, Officers Down Under, Gardaí Down Under. There's a lot of Gardaí working around the world and other police forces. There's Irish-American police officers who are highly experienced, a lot of them very commended. So you could bring in a lot of experienced people who actually know the Irish system, but effectively are loyal to the new boss and will allow them to have some security and basically not be
blindsided. Yeah, what type of names are being bandied around at the moment?
At the moment, we have a dearth of names because people
it's
are looking.
It's boys and chalice people are looking.
They're looking at is there somebody outside and so on. You know, I think at one stage today, Robert Wash, the Secretary General of the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, was mentioned. I'm sure
Robbie would love that.
he might be thrilled with the opportunity to impose discipline on the Gardaí, but. In fairness, I think you need someone from a policing background. They may not have to be an Irish policing background, but. It is like, you know, in any walk of life, you need to understand the job to be able to get the best out of people. And I think it would be a step too far to go for a civilian with no policing experience.
In terms of the politics of this, and if you wanted to trace the, I suppose, the unpopularity of the previous government and its ills, you can trace it back to that night in February 2014 when Martin Callanan received that emissary of the Taoiseach. I mean, it dogged the previous government, the justice issues, policing issues. Is there a sense that perhaps this could dog the current government as well for the next year, given that we have the tribunal, the Charlton Tribunal, given that we have the still ongoing issues around the Garda College and also the breath test, the million breath tests that never were?
Well, they have to get ahead of it because the last government was behind it and was kind of fighting against a deluge of controversies. And ultimately, I mean, Enda Kenny's departure, Enda Kenny could arguably still be Taoiseach had its departure not been hastened. By a Garda controversy in and around Tusla and Maurice McCabe and the establishment of the tribunal and who knew what and when. Like, that was very damaging for him and hastened his departure. Leo Varadkar is now coming up to 100 days as Taoiseach. He has to find a Garda commissioner. He has no Garda commissioner. And that's a serious situation. I don't think anyone in government is under any illusions about that. So, I mean, politically, he has to get ahead of it. They have to get someone in place, I would think, before Christmas, ideally. But people are saying that's not necessarily going to be the case. And this, you know, this future of a lot has been put on this future of policing commission.
How long has this commission been working on its report?
Well, it's been there for about 3 or 4 months, and it's due to report next year. So, I mean, look, it's working pretty speedily.
That's speedy by Irish terms.
Well, it's a whole. You know, structural review of what's going on in Garda Síochána. So I think it's fair enough to allow them to do a year. And I think Michael was saying the other day that there's going to be it's going to be module based as well. I mean, this is almost the panacea, really, isn't it? This is what we're all expecting to be the thing that's going to sort out on Garda Síochána. I suppose it's unfortunate from a timing point of view that we're going to have a new commissioner in place before that report, so ideally anyway. And, you know, what input will the future of policing commission have into the appointment?
Just before we move off this issue, the pay of the Garda commissioner, €180,000, is a lot of money out there. But if you look at the international comparisons, it is quite low. We have a notional cap of pay for the chief executives of the country's biggest banks of €500,000. It's time to get rid of it, surely. I mean, it is an anachronism that we cannot pay any more than this.
I think, bankers' bonuses and pay was very controversial during the recession. But I think when it comes to getting a new Garda commissioner, the government will manage to get public support for paying well above 180,000. People may not like it, but they will take it ahead of a chaos-ridden force. The other thing we should mention, I suppose, in this discussion is just look back at the origins as well of this. Maurice McCabe, the Garda whistleblower, so much of this has stemmed from what he started about a decade ago. And I think the other big mistake Noreen O'Sullivan, Garda management made, and the other government ministers in the past, was to underestimate him. Since he started raising his issues, we've had Alan Shatter leave, Martin Callanan, Noreen O'Sullivan, the Garda confidential recipient, the head of the Department of Justice, and it has just been
Francis Fitzgerald has been shuffled out.
Arguably the Taoiseach as well.
You know, yeah. It certainly contributed. So it's quite astonishing. And I suppose that is probably the biggest lesson for the Gardaí. They better listen to their own this time rather than try and marginalise and dismiss them, because it will blow up in a huge way otherwise.
I suppose one other thing when we're looking at kind of Garda reform is, there's been some discussion in the past 24 hours about how the Gardaí are subject to 10 different oversight bodies. Now, I think that's a bit of an overstatement, but it is fair to say that there is a lot of oversight, probably too much of, on Garda Síochána. You have the Ombudsman, the Policing Authority, the Inspectorate. You have Oireachtas committees. They're accountable to the Justice Committee, to the Public Accounts Committee, the Controller and Auditor General, the Department of Justice as well. So there is an argument, I think, particularly in the case of the Inspectorate, the Authority and the Ombudsman, that there really doesn't need to be all three. Probably just needs to be one body that is in charge, I suppose, of both, identifying ways in which Gardaí can reform, but also handling disciplinary matters as well. I think that the fact that they're subject to so many oversight bodies at this stage is blurring the lines and confusing things a little bit. I mean, the Authority is again presented as this sort of this great thing now that we have in place that's going to be in charge of appointing the new commissioner. You know, and the ombudsman is still there.
A
recommendation of a new commissioner, but I think the government would be loath to ignore that recommendation, given all the controversy that their previous appointment has caused.
We could actually look up north there, because again, we have up there a policing board, which is effectively a policing authority, and a police ombudsman. So you could go from three bodies, certainly to the inspectorate, roll it into the authority. The reason we've had these disparate bodies is because the government are tiptoeing around the Gardaí. We'll give it's you a bit of oversight,
reform,
lads, but not too much. Well, now I think the ground has changed, and there is probably a political opportunity to beef up the regulation, basically, but simplify it.
I'm sure Leo Varadkar hoped to make a speech at the Fine Gael party thinking this weekend that would be about overall economic policy, overall policy for the government ahead of the budget, and also rumours of an election next year. What will Fine Gael try to do now? Because they will really want to lock this issue down and say, look, we'll get on with it. There is no crisis here in justice.
Yeah, they want to set the agenda. I mean, you know, we're coming into the new political season now. The Dáil is back next week. And I think Leo Varadkar will be making a speech this week at the Fine Gael thinking to the effect of, you know, Republic of Opportunity and what that actually means on a practical level. We have the budget in less than a month. So, you know, how's the budget going to be, you know, how are we going to deliver a budget that's going to create a republic of opportunity, I suppose, is the grandiose
term. I'm just
loving
that phrase.
Yeah, I know.
So people like it up in the morning. People like it up
early in the
morning.
You're going to get pretty sick of it pretty soon. It's going to be like the best small country in the world and keep the recovery going. It's going to wear on a lot of people. But, you know, it's a nice idea. There needs to be some flesh on the bones on it. That's what we're being promised, I suppose, this week and in the next few weeks.
Yeah, and you'll I suppose they then have a series of other think-ins, most notably Fianna Fáil next week up in Longford, where they will be doing their own sort of thing. But they will be delighted; they no longer have to go along with that sort of Jesuitical position of the Garda Commissioner should go, but we won't do anything about it. So they'll be glad that's off the agenda at least for now.
Yeah, and while you know the political world and we all focus on the Garda Commissioner, of course, the housing crisis was last week's big issue, and that, to coin a phrase, hasn't gone away. You know,
no, and I think probably the encouraging thing is we're in a crisis, no doubt about it. But from the summit last Friday, we saw about 30 different ideas chucked out there. Some good, some, you know, maybe
send
not.
Them back to the country.
Yeah. Like you have to say, why are we trying to cram people into emergency accommodation in hotels when you have towns and villages around Ireland with empty schools, empty shops, closed down businesses and the possibility and people will be delighted to get an injection into their community. It would have to be handled with care because, as we've seen before, with social mass movements, it can produce a backlash. But I would say anyone in their right mind would say it's better to house people in a community that needs people rather than shoving them into hotels and trying to raise children. It definitely is very upsetting, the notion of 3,000 children in emergency accommodation for a long period of time.
And any sense that the government believes that building homes themselves or giving local authorities more powers and more money to build homes themselves, is that something that could be acceptable government policy soon enough?
Yeah, I think you've seen the shift under Leo Varadkar and Owen Murphy, the housing minister, in the last few months, that they do are kind of bought into this idea that the state needs to be doing more in terms of housing provision and building more houses. So I think you saw that was one of the actions that came out from the meeting last week, was that local authorities would be required to build social houses. They wouldn't be necessarily given money to buy housing, that they would actually have to put you know, shovels in the ground and get houses built. So that will add to the social housing stock in the coming years. The state is not doing nearly enough and isn't even projecting to do nearly enough over the next 4 or 5 years. So, you know, we might get some more announcements around that when Murphy publishes the review of Rebuilding Ireland. But there's an awful lot of work to do. I think one interesting thing to consider is that the next government more than likely will either be Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil leading it. So I do think there's scope for the two parties to get together, you know, under the, I suppose, the auspices of their confidence and supply deal to kind of come up with a common housing strategy of some sorts, where there are at least the broad principles of a housing strategy. Because at the moment you're getting, you know, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael clashing over whether we should cut VAT for construction. Whereas if they actually, you know, sat down and did some joined up thinking on this, we could have a housing policy for the next 5 to 10 years. That could actually do what's really important and what's really going to solve this crisis is build houses, and thousands, tens of thousands of them every year.
Okay, Michael Brennan, our political editor, and Hugh O'Connell, dressed like a Garda sergeant today. Hugh O'Connell, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back in just a moment.
In today's busy world, the Business Post prides itself in quality independent journalism. We provide trusted comment and analysis on the stories that matter. Our award-winning journalists provide in-depth insights on our 7-day digital offering across a mobile responsive website, apps and e-paper. Subscribe today and gain immediate access to a trusted news source.
Hello, Jet. What do you want?
My welcome in, babe.
Everybody thought I had a duster?
Y'all thought old spindle top old Burke Burnett was all it was, didn't you?
Well, I'm here to tell you it ain't, boy. It's here. And there ain't a dang thing you gonna do about it. My well came in big, so big, big, and there's more down there, and there's bigger wells.
Should have shot that fellow a long time ago. Now he's too rich to kill.
Now, there are a lot of people who think the waters around Ireland contain billions and billions of barrels of oil and gas equivalent. They're the same people who believe that Ireland also is host to a fortune in gold and also other metals. Well, investors in Providence Resources, the Irish oil company, this week were brought back down to earth. The company's share price plunged after it said weeks and weeks of drilling about 200 kilometres off the west coast for oil had found absolutely nothing. So what are the prospects for Providence Resources and the prospect of ever recovering oil from around Ireland? Our business correspondent, Jack Horgan-Jones, is with us. Jack, there are many people that will know Providence Resources from its previous days. It used to be Archon. It has some well-known investors like Tony O'Reilly Sr. and his son, Tony Jr., is the chief executive. They put a lot of store and even more money from investors, hundreds of millions, into a drilling program. And what have they found?
Salt water. it's kind of tragic because this company actually seemed to be turning a corner a little while ago. They had this investment agreement from Total, which is a massive global oil and gas heavyweight. The share price was performing again. They closed off a funding round of 74 million quid, which finally gave them a bit of financial breathing room. And people were talking about Providence turning a corner. You know, it looked like they had the money in the bank to really go and act in a quite muscular fashion when they're talking to people about farm-ins at Barry Row, which is the big thing that the company is always aiming towards. And then this summer, a double whammy of bad news. First of all, Druid, salt water in the shaft. And then just, I think, like 3 or 4 weeks later, yesterday, we get the news that Drumbeg has the same fault with it. The net effect of that, as you say, means that the share price is way down, trading at around 5.5p today. And it seems to be, unfortunately, as opposed to turning a corner, it's more of the same for Providence. I mean, they were celebrating 20 years on the Isaac today, but no one's talking about that.
I remember when Providence struck. They did find off the Cork coast, about 50 miles, a thing called Barry Row, which they said, look, we are very confident there is a huge amount of oil and gas in this field. It's very near to the Kinsale field. That's fine. But the really big prospects around Ireland, go off into the Atlantic waters, go off and drill there, and you will find really, really huge quantities of oil and gas. And they've tried, and a bit like sticking a dart on a dartboard blindly, they found nothing. I mean, what does this say about this idea that we are some natural resources country like Norway?
It says that if we are, it's extremely difficult to get the stuff out of the ground above sea level and back onto land. Look, I mean, this to a certain extent is what you sign up for when you get into oil and gas exploration, particularly offshore.
Not for widows and orphans is what the stockbrokers say.
You have to have a lot of cash. You have to have very patient investors and you have to have a serious risk appetite. You know, the thing about Providence is, as you say, they always have had Barry Row, which is the older asset, in the back pocket. They think there's about 330 million barrels of oil there. And that's always been the ace card. You know, they've always had that notionally to fall back on. But I think investors and market observers are becoming increasingly tired of that always being on the Never Never, always being held out there, as you know, eventually we'll get a farming partner into Barry Row. How many times has that been pushed back? You know, now I think these two disappointments at Drumbeg and Druid put the pressure even more on Tony O'Reilly Jr. to actually execute on Barry Row. Now, the time is now to insert foul language here or get off the pot on Barry Row, I think.
I remember speaking to Tony Jr. a couple of years ago, and this was based around, look, we found this thing in Barry Row. It's very big. If you compare it to Kinsale or to Corbfield, as controversial as that was, look, Ireland should now get used to reaping taxpayers should get used to reaping money from these fields. Nothing has happened, and the department give out these licenses, you've got to go through the process of it. Is it time just to give up and say, look, realistically, there's nothing down there?
No, because the potential reward is so great, really, isn't it? I mean, and it's always so depressing and such a dirge when you get nothing but bad news back. But let's not forget, like, when these things do pay off, they pay off big time. But they might pay off for somebody else. They might not pay off for somebody who has spent the years and spent the millions on the unsuccessful exploits. They might pay for the next guy, like a slot machine in Vegas, the next guy who comes along and puts the lucky quarter in. And that's the question, I think, about Tony O'Reilly Jr. Are there no questions about his stewardship of the company?
Well, you have to think at this stage, like, he has promised investors, look, we will do this arrangement with Barry Row whereby we'll extract value from it. It hasn't happened for a number of years. I don't even think I was working for the Sunday Business Post when that was announced. He has gone...
You're rather blowing.
He has gone and spent an awful lot of money on these investments in drilling down off the Atlantic coast. It hasn't worked, you know. Is there a point to say, look, maybe some other company could come in here, take over Providence, or institute management change and start looking at the various other assets? I somehow, for the moment, think that won't happen. But what I do wonder is, will they ever get any value out of the assets that they know where oil is, and that is Barry Row, or will, because they failed to find anything else, people say, look, this company is a busted flush? But I think the wider issue for this is, and I touched on it there, Ireland's oil and gas regime. People accuse the government of giving away these licenses, and they are a slot machine, as you say, for some investors. But go back to the 1970s, not that I was around back then, but you had the major oil companies around the world, the household names. They tried back then with the technology that was around, and they found nothing. This is surely a pipe dream that investors should just be aware of.
Yeah, it should be. I mean, look, as I said, it's oil and gas. You're more likely to lose your money than get it back, really, in the grand scheme of things, I think. And I think that's what a lot of Providence shareholders will be, that's a reality they're going to be confronting over the next little while. Look at how the share price has performed. It's not great. I mean, it's slid off the edge of a cliff. One thing I think has been interesting has been the activity of Pageant, though, long-term shareholder there.
That's an investment company owned by Nick Furlong, who's invested in a lot of Irish companies on the stock exchange, seeks a bit of value, knows how to play the markets.
Yeah, and you said it, you put your finger on the button there yourself, Ian. He seeks value and knows how to play markets, and they have been big buyers over the last little while since the Drew disappointment. And then just again this morning, they were buying shares again despite the Drumbeg disappointment. So, I mean, some people do see value there. I mean, and undoubtedly there is value in the company. It's also well funded. You know, this is not a company that is on death's door. They got a cash injection as a result of that Total deal they did on Drumbeg, even though that'll amount to naught eventually. And they did a share placing last year, which enabled them to raise about 74 million quid. They paid off some legacy legal costs, I think, and paid off some debt. So, I mean, it's not as if they're going to have to tap shareholders again. And it's not as if they're going to disappear overnight. It's just that what's around the corner is not quite clear. I'm not quite sure what Pageant see, but they definitely see something the way they're buying.
Yeah, look, I'm a cynic about a lot of this exploration activity around Ireland, and I know you, in recent weeks, you were writing about Conroy Diamonds and Gold, and they have had, look, they're saying we've got a gold mine in Ireland. I mean, what is it about these people, Richard Conroy, who have been known to people around Providence, Archon, Atlantic Resources, Tony O'Reilly Sr., they were all involved in the scene. They're all incredibly optimistic, and has anybody actually made money out of anything on this island?
They're all dreamers, Ian, you know? But no, I think, look, the thing that binds a lot of these people together is they're all fairly wealthy already. You know, they may have had...
They're a lot wealthier if they put their money in a safe investment.
Yeah, but they may have had, you know, I mean, certainly Richard Conroy, I think, had some massive successes gold mining in in Alaska back in the 70s or something like that. And I think he's quite financially secure because of that. And, you know, they form these companies and they've reached a stage of their lives where they want to kind of, you know, have one massive blowout and they're financially secure already. So, I mean, it's a labor of love and the night is always darkest before the dawn for them. You know, they always think the payoff is just around the corner, and they always seem most interestingly to be able to convince investors that's the case as well.
Yeah, and I suppose everybody points out to, if you were to talk to Aidan Heavey and Pat Plunkett of Tullow Oil, people would say, look, we took a punt on these guys when they were penny stocks and then they turned into global oil giants, but they are the one-off. They are the ones that get very lucky. Everybody else just loses money.
Yeah, they're the exception that proves the rule, and even Tullow in recent days or recent years hasn't had a great time of it.
Yeah, I'm just kind of wondering though, you know, what is it about the Irish investor that still is prepared to pump money into exploration stocks? If you told somebody, look, we've got a prospect of gold, natural resources, onshore, offshore, no matter how unlikely it is, we're still prepared to put money into them.
I don't, for some reason, I don't see you sinking your massive investment fund into exploration stocks anytime soon.
No, the trust fund is more safer assets, but cash.
Like Sunday Business Post shares.
Cash that's losing money more likely. But just in terms of, and just to wrap this up, around Providence, again, we've seen the share price fall. It's come back a tiny little bit from where it was, but the immediate pressure on the company, is there anything that they've got left? Any other drilling assets around Ireland, or is it all now play on Barry Row?
They've got plenty of assets, but I mean, as we've discussed at length already, an asset does not make income-producing asset. Just a notional concession asset does not an income-producing asset make. So yeah, I think the pressure's on Barry Road. They got to show a direction of travel. They got to show that they can get a deal over the line there, and they got to show that it's a good deal as well.
Okay, Jack Corgan-Jones, thank you very much for joining us. That's all for the Post podcast this week. More business news and analysis online on businesspost.ie. We'll be back next week.